Hello, friends and colleagues. I'm Jim Birch for the Bureau of Justice Assistance. We invite you to join our conversation with former Chief and Police Commissioner Bill Bratton about the concept of predictive policing. In this edition, I'm joined by Chris Rose, Acting Director for the National Institute of Justice, as we talk to Chief Bratton about his thoughts and concepts on predictive policing. Thank you both for taking the time to talk about this with us today. Chris, why don't you start things off?
The meeting, the symposium on predictive policing, it's a lot of discussion, a lot of buzz around the definitional issues around predictive policing. And I was wondering, in your view, if you could tell us how you think predictive policing is different from some of the other policing concepts that are already out there, such as intelligence or information-led policing, data-driven policing, CompStat, et cetera.
Well, actually, it is not different. It is part of the evolution of policing. And indeed, one of the purposes of this first predictive policing symposium that the National Institute of Justice is sponsoring is to see if we might be able to arrive at a definition of predictive policing that all of the various players, academics, researchers, police, community, can agree on. Community policing was introduced now almost 20 years ago, and we still differ as to what is the actual definition of community policing, but I think it has evolved into a recognition that community policing is about partnership, it's about problem solving, and it's about prevention. And if you think of what you just described in terms of what is the difference between predictive policing and intelligence-led policing or information-led policing, it is not that there's a difference, it's rather there's a building upon what came before. Community policing, with its emphasis on partnership, part of that partnership was to share information. So from that information, we could create intelligence. The fusion centers that were created after 9/11 with federal agencies, state agencies, local agencies, it's all about sharing of information, developing intelligence faster so we can more quickly respond to it. Predictive policing is taking advantage of the evolution of that concept where we can gather information more quickly than ever in the past, analyze it, and from that actually begin to predict that certain actions based on our intelligence are going to occur and seek to prevent them. And so this is not a standalone type of concept. It is very much a significant enhancement of what has come before and what is still actually evolving.
Chief, when you talk about predictive policing, a lot of it sounds almost futuristic, but we know from our discussions here already today and from talking to you that there are predictive policing elements underway already here in Los Angeles and in other places. Can you give us a couple of examples of where that's happening?
In Los Angeles, with a significant gang problem, we know that the gangs, many of them celebrate their anniversary dates, the anniversary of their creation, by having large get-togethers where gang members gather. Other gangs being aware that on a specific date, at a specific time, at a specific location, there's going to be a large target pool, have historically in the past oftentimes taken advantage of that to attack. Or the very volatile nature of gangs themselves, even though they're all part of the same gang, you get them together, they've got guns, they've got tempers, and oftentimes there's flare-ups. So here in Los Angeles, we watch those birth dates very closely, and based on the past history that we are able to predict that if we're not there, that there's apt to be significant levels of violence associated with that celebration. So we are usually there in very large numbers. That's a simple form of predictive policing. A more recent experience, and one that's taking advantage of the evolution of policing, the ability to gather information much more quickly and make intelligence out of it. Crime mapping, computerized crime mapping, something that even the smallest departments in America can now acquire very cheaply, real-time crime mapping. USA Today, a couple of months ago, had a story about a department, small department, 60, 70-person department, had just acquired a real-time crime mapping system. That is, police dispatchers were receiving reports of crime, they were able to enter it, and it was going up on a map in their operations center. And it became very quickly apparent one morning, calls coming in, that there were a group of vandals moving through the city, shooting out windows on cars. And with that real-time information, they saw a pattern and a trend evolving, and predicted where the vandals, what direction they were going, positioned their police resources, and sure enough, here come the vandals shooting out windows, coming right into the police dragnet, if you will. There's a recent real-time predictive policing success story. And predictive policing isn't just about large departments like Los Angeles or New York with the huge computer systems and resources we have to work with. The smallest departments in America today can basically, for relatively minimal money, have that type of capability.
That's great. And in both of those examples, we noticed that in both cases, using that information resulted in a reduced number of victims, the first being violent crime, the second property crime.
And going back to our earlier discussion about this not being something new, but rather the evolution of what's already been, community policing, with its focus on prevention, partnership problem solving prevention, the idea is not to measure success by arrests that occur after the fact, but measure success by what you're preventing. The officers that morning prevented a lot more vehicles from having their windows shot out. Our gang officers in Los Angeles, we know for certainty, based on past history, prevent serious acts of violence when we get there on those gang anniversary dates, and basically there in a very visible way. There's also another concept, the idea of victimization. The Chicago school system has identified, through use of intelligence that's been made out of information, a number of young people in that school system who are, they predict that without some type of intercession on behalf of the school department, will likely experience victimization, will likely be victims of shootings in the school system. And that system is up and running, and it will be very interesting to watch as it evolves. But there's a really very creative use of a lot of intelligence information that's being used to focus not on perpetrators of crime, but potential victims who, based on their demographic trending and characteristics, we can predict with some degree of certainty some number of them will be the victims of crime. But we can prevent that by basically interceding or getting engaged in their life in some way, intervening.
Chief, you mentioned the smaller departments getting involved in predictive policing as well, not just limiting it to the larger departments. Can you tell us a little bit about if a law enforcement executive or chief from a smaller department came to you and said, you know, I don't have the resources to do this predictive policing thing. Can I still do it? Is it possible to do it without that kind of financial?
Basically, I would say they're just making excuses. There is no reason that any department can't do this. 30 years ago, as a young lieutenant in the Boston Police Department, I had maps on my wall and little pushpins where each morning I would track all the crime reports from the day before and put them up in the map. And very quickly, within several days, you could see hot spots developing. That was well before the existence of computers and all the ability that we now have to see these beautiful colorized maps on our computer screens. Indeed, the creation of CompStat in the NYPD began with initially maps on flip charts with plastic acetate that we had to borrow $10,000 from the police foundation to buy the plastic acetate in the largest police department in America. That's how crime mapping and hotspot policing began. And so what did that cost? It's $10,000 in a 40,000-person department. So any chief that gives you the argument, we can't afford it, I'm sorry, the small department has smaller amounts of crime to report, to track and the map. And this is not rocket science. This is basic policing 101.
Let's talk a little bit about the other partner in this, the community. How do we prepare a community for this predictive policing evolution, if you will?
A concern of the community, and rightfully so, is this issue of civil liberties. As we seek to use more and more data and information that are available through computer analysis, there is a concern of privacy. There is a concern of civil liberties. And that is something that needs to be discussed. It needs to be discussed openly. It needs to be researched. It needs to be reviewed. I am comfortable that if we do that in a transparent way, if we admit up front that there are these fears and concerns and potential issues, that we should not use that as an excuse to dismiss moving forward, but rather find a way to ensure that the public is kept informed that everything we are doing is legal, is constitutional, and ultimately will be for their benefit. Case in point, a great deal of concern about the increasing use of cameras in public spaces. Well, police will tell you what a valuable tool that is now, whether it's public cameras or private cameras, how frequently those help us to solve crime. And the Supreme Court of this country has indicated that there is not an expectation of privacy in a public place. And while organizations, say, like the American Civil Liberties Union, continue to voice concerns about that, we have the constitutional ability to use those systems for the betterment of the public, the prevention of crime. But we always have to be reminded that this is a tool that is available to us that cannot be abused. As predictive policing moves forward, as community policing did, as problem-solving policing did, as broken windows policing did, we need to be mindful of legal issues, constitutional safeguards, and to discuss openly the concerns of the public, of the media, of civil liberties groups, and be prepared to address it. And if, in fact, we find that we are going outside the guardrails, then we need to very quickly get back within the guardrails and not risk overturning what is an extraordinarily useful tool for policing to prevent crime.
Chief, the conversation that we've started here today, I think, is a very beneficial one and one that we're all going to look forward to using in the coming months and weeks. I know that the Bureau of Justice Assistance and National Institute of Justice are both planning to work together to continue to hold this dialogue and to continue to bring in new perspectives so that we can take it as far as the concept will allow.
Thank you for taking the time to join us for this conversation. If you found the discussion interesting, we encourage you to visit the BJA website for more innovative ideas and best practices at www.ojp.gov/BJA. To learn more about predictive policing and the topics discussed at the first Predictive Policing Symposium held in Los Angeles, please visit the National Institute of Justice website at www.ojp.usdoj.gov/NIJ. Please note, NIJ is in all lowercase. From all of us here at BJA, thank you for tuning in to today's podcast. We hope you'll join us again for another edition of BJA's Justice Podcast Series.